because I've got to get ready for our speaker. It is my great privilege. In fact, I jumped at the opportunity to be leader tonight when I heard who Sonny had snagged to speak for us. It's my great honor to introduce Cornell.
Wow, I'm nervous. Hey, I'm Cornell.
Cornell!
So maybe I'll find some dignity. Maybe I'll find a wife tonight. I'll keep coming back. Whew. The other day I was walking, it was yesterday or day before yesterday, I went to the gym and I was walking back to my car. I heard these keys jingling behind me. And I was getting so pissed off how close this person was following me. I kept walking. I was like, just keep walking. Don't turn around. You don't need to turn around. Then I heard his water bottle shake. And I was like, keep walking. Don't need to turn around. Then I realized it was my keys and my water bottle. In my backpack. Wow. My name's Cornell and I'm a real Al-Anon. See, what that says to me is, you know, I come into these rooms, and I used to start off like this, because I went to a lot of AA meetings, and I love AA. I don't love it so much right now, just because I'm going through a hard time as an Al-Anon, right? But I used to go to a lot of AA meetings. I went to as many AA meetings as I did Al-Anon meetings for the first 3-4 years. And I learned this phrase to say that. I used to get up here, and I used to say, my name's Cornell, I have alcoholism, I have a living mind-powered disease, it affects the way I look at people, places, things, and situations in the day that I'm in. It makes me restless, irritable, discontent. I have a mind that's fault-finding, judgmental, and opinionated. Looks out at the day, looks out at the world that I'm in, and never tells me a good thing about myself. Tells me my bank account's too low, my car's not good enough, where I live's not good enough, the number on the scale's too high. Used to say all this stuff, right? And it was not that it wasn't true, but it began to be... not canned, but it began to be something that I lost touch with the reality of, right? So I had the facility to say it, the facility to name what was wrong with me, and I thought that that knowledge was an inoculation against what I have learned is still wrong with me as I've gone through the most difficult year in my life in recovery this past year. I started dating someone who drinks alcohol daily and takes pills every day. Obama out. Right? That just about says it all. And the last year... last year, 12 to 14 months, I found myself moving further and further and further and further away from the program of recovery. I found myself not attending as many meetings, not talking to my sponsor, not reading literature, not getting on my knees in the morning and praying, not doing the things that I did when I was in recovery that started to change and alter and transform my life. And predictably, my life got worse, and my life got smaller. My life got more isolated. My life got less interesting to me. I didn't have as many connections to people. I didn't have any connections to my passions or my interests or my creativity. I lost all that. I lost it little bit by little bit by little bit, investing more and more and more and more in this other person and investing less and less and less and less and less in myself. So I tell that little story about walking through the gym and thinking and kind of being pissed off at myself because I realize that no matter what I do in the rooms of recovery, I have to understand for my own sanity that this disease is inside of me. And this past year, I think, has really been about the world teaching me, the universe teaching me, recovery teaching me, that the disease of untreated alcoholism, trauma, abuse, neglect, dysfunction, however I want to describe it, that it's deeply embedded in me. It creates within me a structure of feelings, perceptions, beliefs, attitudes, ideas, and behaviors with which I interface with the world that cause me problems, that cause me wreckage, that cause hurt feelings, that get me tangled and tied up with other people, that create delusional expectations of the world and others to make me feel better in my own life. So, let me tell you a bit about my story, I guess. I come from an alcoholic family. My father was a raging, violent alcoholic. I have a new sponsor, and I started working the steps again with this new sponsor. And for the first time in my life in recovery, I've actually started to look at my father and understand the implications of my father's behavior in my life, the lessons that I learned in the alcoholic home, the models that I absorbed in the alcoholic home about relationships, about love, about pain, about tolerance of pain. My father was a violent man. My father beat me, he beat my mother. He was an alcoholic, sex addict, drug addict. He used to choke me at the dinner table when I wouldn't eat the food he wanted me to eat. My sister used to take me underneath the stairs while he beat my mother so I wouldn't hear it, her screams as loud. He was a violent, violent man. And I learned a lot of lessons in that home. I learned that two people in a relationship who say they love each other fight like hell, and they don't leave each other. They bring each other down to the bottom, and they wound each other, and they tear each other apart. It gets less sad than this. But I feel it's important to go back to the causes and conditions, the origins and the foundation, so I understand the deep powers that are inside of me that shape and inform my perception of the world so that I don't think I got here because I'm crazy. I'm not crazy, right? What happened to me was real. What happened to me shaped me and marked me profoundly and set me on a trajectory in my life that was unavoidable. That's the one thing I learned here too. How I got marked and deformed and damaged in the alcoholic home set me on a course of interaction with the world and its people and its places and its things and its situations that was unavoidably going to lead me to wreckage and confrontation and disappointment and frustration and bitterness and resentment and anger. So my father used to make me go get his belt when I was a kid. He would say, go get my belt, because he was gonna beat me with it. And I was like, please, Dad, no, please, please, please don't. I'll do anything. I'll do anything. I'll promise anything. I'll say anything. Go get the belt, boy, or you're gonna get something worse. So I would take my little five-year-old self, walk upstairs into his bedroom, open his closet door. I'm shaking, I'm humiliated, I'm enraged, I'm scared, I'm terrified. I'm close to being in shock. I would reach up, I would take down his belt, I would walk downstairs, I'd give him his belt, and he would beat me. Now, I learned a lot of things in this alcoholic home. I learned a lot of things in these violent confrontations. And it's important for me to understand what I did learn. I learned that I'm responsible for somebody else's violence towards me. I learned that I'm supposed to figure out a way to make up for somebody's rage, anger towards me, that it's my fault, that I must have done something wrong, that I'll promise anything and I'll do anything and I'll pray anything and I'll be any way you need me to be. Just stop doing what you're doing to me. Tell me that you love me. Tell me that you need me. Tell me that you want me. Tell me I'm a good boy. Tell me that I'm your son. So in this alcoholic home, these lessons become very powerfully like embedded in it, right? And they shape the way I see reality. They shape the way I understand love. Seeing my mother beaten, seeing my sister humiliated, right? These shape the way I interact with the world. And so it's no mistake that when I go out into the world with this warped set of understandings and ideas and beliefs about the world, that things don't really go so well. Now, I was able to mask it for a long time in my life. I was able to develop a character that adapted to the insanity of the alcoholic home so that I could survive, that was built upon very key foundations that I learned about in this room. Right? It was built upon people-pleasing, built upon earning love, proving my self-worth, doing anything I needed to do to seek validation, praise, and approval, mercilessly driven to seek validation, praise, and approval, not settled until I know that you care about me or love me or want me or think I'm good. You know, when David Brother here said, the most important person in the room tonight, I had to stop myself from standing up. Because that's what I want to be. I want to be the most important person in the room tonight. I want to know that. And there's a part of me, right? So I have to look into my heart. And I've got to see what is in my heart, how my heart got marked by that confrontation with the disease of alcoholism. Right? I didn't get marked by pretty things, right? There's no pretty cave painting that someone's going to explore in my heart. They're very, very violently etched drawings that got marked on me. And part of that is not pretty to talk about. And part of it is difficult to admit to, that I do get jealous, that I am competitive, that I have an arrogant streak, that I want to be better than, that I want to show off, that I want to be seen as more than you. Right? Not because I necessarily even believe that that's true, but it's such a drive within me to be seen in that way so that it repairs the sense of damage to my own self-worth that was created in the alcoholic home, where I felt like I was nothing, that I was nobody, that I was unwanted, that I was unloved, that I was alone, that these things will pop out in me, right? These stains that are in my heart, these stains, these energies that are in my heart that block me from true relationship with my fellows, that block me from true relationship with anything else in the world, that block me from a true relationship with a power greater than myself, that block me with serenity and peace and forgiveness and tolerance and patience, that block me from experiencing those things. Because I become the power in my life, right? That's the other thing I learned in the alcoholic home, that I'm the power in my life. I'm the one who's in charge of solving all the problems. I'm the one who's in charge of coming up with all the solutions. I'm the one who has to come up with all of the ways in which I re-prove and re-earn my self-worth. So I went out into the world, and also in the alcoholic home, my mother tried to commit suicide twice. And eventually my father left. And he found us one night, because we ran away from him. And he found us. We had lived upstate New York, and he was downstate. And we moved to Long Island. We ran away to Long Island. And one night he found us. And he came into the home with a butcher knife in one hand and a bottle of Canadian Club in the other. And he set about to destroy the home. He set about to tear it apart with the knife, and he almost killed my mother that night. And then right before he collapsed, he sat in a chair, he was drunk, and he said to me, son, my mother said to him, Cornell, his name was Cornell, she said, Cornell, please leave, for your son's sake, leave. And he was just conscious enough to look up and say, son, what son? I don't have a son. And I ran to him, and I told my sponsor this story, and I ran to him, and I screamed, and I cried, and I was like, Daddy, Daddy, I'm your son, I'm your son. Don't say that, take it back, I'm your son, I'm your son, I'm your son. And that's the last thing he ever said to me. And for me, it always marked me and shaped me as somebody who was rejected by, because I was born in 1967 in a family of I have a black father and a white mother. You know, this is long before it was presidentially fashionable to be interracial. Right? It was long before those days. And so it marked me very, very deeply because I was rejected by my white family and I was rejected by my black family because of the racism and the alcoholism that pervaded both sides of the family. So when my father said, you're not my son, I felt it as this and I carried it for 40 years as this primal kind of defining moment in my life of being unloved and unwanted by the man whose spawn I was. And I shared this with my new sponsor, And he said to me, Cornell, do you know why your father said that to you? And finally, the answer was going to come. The answer I had been waiting for, to understand this kind of Greek tragedy that had defined my character for so long. I said, you know why your father said that to you? Because he was fucked up. I was like, what? I had held on to this moment in my life for 40 years. My dad was just fucked up. He said he probably didn't even remember saying it. That was a very powerful moment for me. Very powerful and telling moment for me. Because I had hung on to the memories of the violence of the alcoholic home as if it was a personal assault upon me, and it's not. It's a disease. My father had no idea what he was doing. He had no idea. He had no control. He was sick. He had no capacity to do anything but what was done to him. So it set me off on a course in my life of looking to broken people to fix me, and wounded people to heal me, and angry people to soothe me, and self-hating people to teach me self-love. Over and over and over and over and over again. All this time I thought in my relationships, because I have been a serial monogamist for 25 years. I'm pretty good at it. I can get into something. I can't get out until it becomes detrimental to all parties involved. I would go on in my life to attempt suicide several times. I'd be institutionalized in a psychiatric ward. I'm no longer there. Unless you're there with me and I'm imagining all of this. Right, but it marked me very, very, very deeply, the disease of alcoholism and the way it taught me how to perceive the world. And so, year after year after year after year after year, one relationship after another, after another, after another, after another, after another, for 25 years. And it went something like this. I don't like you. I'm gonna fall in love with you. I'm not really that interested in you, but maybe we've had sex and now I'm stuck to you. I didn't get to know you. I became enmeshed with you. I became entangled with you. I thought you were supposed to now answer all my needs. I didn't know there was any other source for the answering of my needs besides somebody else. Right, so my whole identity, and I hear it in these rooms and I've heard it in other people, my whole identity becomes fixated on getting something out there to fix something inside me, getting someone to give me something, pleading with someone. You know, I got very good, like when I was told to get on my knees in Al-Anon and to pray, it was very difficult for me to do that. I was very good at getting on my knees and begging somebody not to leave me. It became a kind of a ritual. The relationship would progress. It would get worse and worse and worse. I'd become more progressively unmanageable. My life would begin to fall apart. My life would begin to get smaller. My life would begin to get out of control. I'd lose interest in everything. The person would leave, and I would do the dance of getting on my knees and demoralizing humiliation and begging another person not to leave me. Begging, screaming, crying. And all this time in recovery, until I started working with my new sponsor, all this time in recovery, I thought it was my mother that I'd been trying to get back through these series of relationships. All this time, that's what I was in psychoanalysis for 10 years on the couch in New York City on the Upper East Side, and I know more about Cornell than is legally allowable, and I figured this is what's going on. It's the mother. It's the individuation from the mother that didn't take place that I'm repeating over and over and over and over and over again. right? That's what I thought was happening with all these relationships. And I started working with my new sponsor, and I realized I never looked at alcoholism of my father. I never looked at the dynamic between me and him and the things that happened and the relationship that we developed and the powerful needs that went unmet between a father and a son that I was repeating over and over and over and over again with all of these relationships. My sponsor did something very helpful for me that opened up my eyes in another way too. He just said, name instances when you have been powerless over alcohol. You know, specific instances. That was very powerful for me because I like to think abstractly and philosophically and, you know, but he was like, a specific instance. Oh, I asked her not to do cocaine and she did cocaine. Oh, I'm powerless over that. I was powerless over my father's drinking. I was powerless over the way he drank. I was powerless over how much he drank. I was powerless over when he drank. He was drunk every single day of my life, all throughout the day. Never knew my father's sober breath in his life, sober moment in his life. Right? So that powerlessness, my not knowing that, creates the compulsion to manage and control and to seek a solution that's for an unsolvable situation. Right? So that powerlessness and my unawareness of it compels me to try to fix something that's unfixable, to try to get a need met from something where a need cannot be met. And that leads to unmanageability. Right? The program got real simple for me, has gotten real simple for me lately, because I've been in so much pain, I've needed simple things to get me up off my knees again. Get me back down on my knees for a higher power, but up off my knees in pursuit of another human being to give me what only a higher power can give me. So this has been a very interesting journey for me, right? It's really, you know, I always heard in these rooms, they say you can't be too dumb for recovery, but you can be too smart for it, you know? And the power that I had to develop, the belief that I had to develop in my own mind, as the source of all my solutions, helped me in some areas, but really did debilitate me. It really has injured me in some ways because I believed I could figure things out. And today I know I can't. Today I know I don't want to. Today I know I don't have to. Today I know it's impossible to. Today I know I'm not God. Today I know I don't have to be God. Today I know I don't have to solve anybody's problem. I was on the phone with my sister the other day, and she's going through a difficult time, and she came from the same crazy home that I came from, and her marriage is falling apart. She's got two kids. Her house is double mortgage. She's losing the house. It's upside down, the mortgage. I've given her money in the past. I've tried to help her out. I'm not a millionaire. I got to take care of myself. She calls me up. She says, she's texting me. She says, I need to talk to you. I start to sweat because I know what's coming. And I know I got to defend myself in some way against opening up my wallet and giving more than I have or taking care of somebody's problems that I can't take care of, and I'm nervous. And so I sit down at my desk and I type on my computer screen in the biggest font that I can, I am not the solution. And I pick up the phone and I call her. And I stare at this the entire time I'm on the phone. I am not the solution. I am not the solution. I am not the solution. And my sister got to talk to me. She got to tell me what she's going through. She got to tell me how she's feeling. She got to share with me her experience of the struggle she's going through. Not once did she ask me for anything. I got to listen and be a source of support for her. I got to not worry about having to figure anything out for her. I got to be relieved of the delusion that I'm supposed to figure something out for her life. I got to give her the dignity of sharing with her brother the difficult time she's going through. So that was a gift. That's another gift, right? I'm learning. I am not the solution. I so want to be the solution in everybody's life. I would go to many colleges. I could get into the best colleges in the country. I could never finish, right? I got into I finished one college. I finished Georgetown University. I got into West Point. I dropped out. I was at Juilliard. I dropped out. I went to a PhD program at Pittsburgh. I dropped out. I went to Stony Brook. I dropped out. I went to all these schools and I dropped out. Right, so I could get into really, really good places and I could never stay. I could do really good things in my life and never follow through. I never had the commitment to follow through because I never understood that what was holding me back was not a lack of intelligence or a lack of ability or a lack of a creativity. It was that I'd get tangled up in these situations that I was in and I'd begin pursuing other things. I'd get into a relationship and everything would fall apart. I'd get into a romantic entanglement and everything would fall apart and I'd quit and I'd leave and I'd go on to something else. I've left homes, I've left apartments, I've moved to different cities, driven by a merciless obsession to either get away from somebody or find somebody else. This has been the power of alcoholism in my life, to shape and mark me that profoundly, that great opportunities have been presented to me, wonderful things. I've had some of the best opportunities the country has to offer a person. And many, many times I have not been able to avail myself of those opportunities because of this thing that always kept coming back, this thing that always kept reemerging in my life. Alcoholism, untreated trauma, untreated family dysfunction. And a lack of awareness that I was continually generating the disturbance inside of me that was causing me to find situations that I could manifest the conditions that I grew up in. All the time this was happening to me. And I just never knew it. You know, live and let live. I didn't know what that meant. Live my way and let's live my way. You know, that's what I wanted you to do. I wanted you to live exactly how I lived. Say exactly what I need you to say. Be exactly how I need you to be. Want exactly what I need you to want. Give exactly what I need you to give. And if you didn't, I thought there was something wrong with me. Right? So, I know I'm going around and around this theme tonight, you know, but it's so vital right now in my own awakening. It's so vital right now in my own understanding of how I got back down on the bottom. How I hit another bottom in recovery. How does that happen, right? It happens when I begin to forget that I get a daily reprieve contingent upon the maintenance of my spiritual condition, that the ego has tremendous recuperative powers. I hear in these rooms all the time, we're in here recovering from our disease and our disease is outside doing push-ups. I hear that all the time. And I understand what that means now. It's not just a slogan to me any longer. It's that when I become too big for my britches, when I think I know too much, that's when this disease can come back and take me down again. That's when this disease can come back and make my life small again. And thank God I had, you know, I'm a freelancer and I booked some work a couple of months before I met this last relationship that I had. And I've booked very little work since then. But that job was able to take me through the year, two or three months. So my whole life didn't fall apart. So I could fall apart, but my life was okay because of the years of recovery I had behind me. So my life held me while I fell to this place of awareness. Because that's what it is for me now. It's like, it's. Can you hear me? It went out.
There you go.
So. All right. So now we got 10 minutes left for the good stuff. So the good news is that there is a solution. Right? That's the good news that I've understood today. That these 12 steps, having a program of recovery, the spiritual principles embodied in them, the application of them in my life, is a real solution, is a true solution to what's wrong with me. I'm in the middle of a 1990. This is my 48th meeting, as my sponsor says, who's counting? 48th meeting in about 51 days. And I cannot explain to you, if you've never done a 99, I've never done a 99 or anything close to it, right? But the transformation that's happened since I began this 51 days ago has been remarkable to me. It's been truly, truly transformational. And it didn't break until last weekend. I was going through a lot of pain, a lot of suffering, a lot of struggle. I was crying, I was broken, I was humiliated, I was whatever, right? I was back in the old. You know, somebody didn't give me what I wanted, or I wasn't getting something I thought I deserved. I was back in hurts and harms, right? the last 51 days has been so vital to my waking up again. Because what I've got was an understanding that I can't recover by myself. Each one of these meetings I've gone to in the last 51 days, somebody has said something, multiple people have said something that has helped me little bit by little bit, day by day, heal. Day by day, come back alive. Day by day, be able to stand up again and say, you know what? I want my own life. I want a life. I want my life. I want my life. God, for the first time in my life, I understand that I want my life. I want to know what I'm capable of. I want to know what the world has waiting for me. I want to be able to wake up and show up and give the best of myself that I can give. And have a way to do that. And not think that I'm supposed to be solving the crisis of the world. I became such an activist when I was in college, and I was a Marxist, and I was fighting against the world, and I was going to bring down the capitalist system, and I was angry in the streets, and I was beaten up by the police and run over by their horses and taken in their police cars. And one time, me and my buddy Jed, we got arrested. We were in the back of a police car, we were handcuffed, and we started singing "Free Nelson Mandela." We're out of our minds. Just trying to fight against anything I could fight against so I could feel okay. Trying to destroy the world so that I could find a place where I fit in. I felt like I didn't belong anywhere. And so I would go to any lengths to destroy anything I thought needed to be destroyed so that I could feel comfortable in who I was. Today I know none of that is necessary. Right? Today I know that the true battle, the true struggle, the true place where I must seek peace is inside of myself. Right? I didn't know that. I truly did not know that. Even all these years in recovery, I never truly understood that in the way that I do now. And then it happened. Literally about 3 or 4 days ago, I said, you know what? I'm done talking to the world. I'm done asking the world to solve my problems. I'm done looking to a woman to make up for things and to give me things and to say things to me and to look at me in a way that's going to heal the wounds that she has no power to heal. I'm done looking to people, places, things, situations, money, property, prestige. I'm done asking the world to fix me. I'm done trying to show up to prove to the world by trying to fix everything in it that I'm a good person, that I'm worthy, that I deserve love. I'm done looking outside. And like I said, 3 or 4 days ago it happened. I started talking to God. And I said to myself, I'm going to start. I've heard this in the rooms and I've never done it before. I said, I'm just going to start sharing everything with God. I'm going to start telling my God every single thing I feel. I don't want anybody else to touch her, God. I don't want anybody else to have her. I'm angry about that. I'm jealous. It hurts. It's painful. It's not fair. It's unjust. I'm self-pitying right now. I need you to know that, God. That's what I'm feeling right now.
Cornell. You never really liked her anyway.
And that is the truth. What I'm finding, and it's not to disparage this woman that I was with, because she's a good woman, she's a good person, but we were a toxic brew, right? Because there was no real, there was trauma bonding, right? That's what it was, right? That's precisely what it was. And I was looking to her for things that she couldn't give me, and she was looking to me for things that I couldn't give her. But what I realized is that if I'm willing, in the day that I'm in, no matter what I'm feeling, no matter how childish it feels, right? Because I heard somewhere that God doesn't have any grandchildren. So no matter how childish it feels, if I'm willing to share my heart and my soul and my pain and my worries and my frustrations and my anxieties and my hopes and my dreams and my desires with a power greater than myself, and I talk to that power, literally talk to that power, I get relief inside. That's all that happens. I get relief inside. I heard in these rooms that the 12 steps are designed to give me a relationship with a power greater than myself, and I understand what that means today. I'm beginning to truly understand that it's not about fixing the world. It's not about fixing a relationship. It's not about fixing a situation. It's not about fixing another alcoholic. It's not about fixing my past. It's about unburdening the things that are in my heart that block me from true fellowship, that block me from appreciating the day and the sky and the trees and the breeze and the winds and the mountains and the clouds, and about feeling a fellowship not just with humanity but with existence. That's what I'm beginning to feel. I know I might sound mystical and hokey, but I'm not usually that way, but that's what I'm beginning to feel today when I wake up in the mornings now. And I say the prayer my sponsor has directed me to say right now as I've left the third step, but I'm starting the fourth step. But I say the third step prayer every morning. God, I offer myself to thee to build with me and to do with me as thou wilt. Relieve me of the bondage of self that I may better do thy will. Take away my difficulties, that victory over them may bear witness to those that I would help of thy power, thy love, and thy way of life. May I do thy will always. And then I've been directed to say this: I trust you. I trust you. I have never trusted another living thing in my life, but I'm beginning to trust my higher power. I'm beginning to trust the guidance that comes, not through telling me what to do or where to go, but the guidance that comes when I offer and unburden my heart, and the relief that I get. Just the relief. And then what comes, comes, and it's okay, no matter what it is. But I'm okay inside. So this program, and maybe the journey I've had to go through this past year that's been so difficult, that's part of my recovery too. Right? That's all part of my program of recovery. I needed to be broken down again so that I could truly understand where the real power was. And today, I know, and I'm so glad, and I'm so relieved that it's not me. It is not me. It never was me. It never was my father. The power was never in my mother. The power was never in my sister. The power was never in my grandmother. The power was never in my grandfather. The power was never in anybody in the generations of my family. The power was never there. We all got tangled up and confused, thinking we each had the power to solve each other's problems. I need to be tangled up and confused when I go to the proper power that can restore me to peace, so that I can offer energies that are embodied in principles that bring me fellowship with other people. And that's a gift, such a gift in my life today, a genuine gift. Thank you for letting me share. It's good to be here tonight.